while we were in the middle of recording today's episode, talking about the NBA playoffs, breaking news dropped. Greg Popovich stepped down as head coach of the San Antonio Spurs, moving into a front office role. We did talk about that. We didn't hit on Mitch Johnson being hired as the next head coach of the San Antonio Spurs. Just giving you a heads up about that before you listen to today's episode with me and Tom Haverstraw. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got a good one tonight talking about the NBA playoffs with Tom Haverstraw. Tom, how you doing?
It's great. It's Friday. How we doing, Kev?
I'm doing really good, man. We had an interesting night of NBA games on Thursday with the Knicks beating the Pistons, closing them out, Jalen Brunson game-winning three, and then the Clippers extending the series to a game seven, which will be on Saturday, 111-105. Clippers beat the Nuggets at home. Tom, where do you want to start? Which series do you want to start with, Tom?
Can we talk about Jalen Brunson's shot? I mean, that crossover was unreal. It's got to be up there with the best shots in Knicks history. I mean, you're talking about the stakes, the fact that it was against Asar Thompson, who had blanketed him this entire series. And I thought, going down like the last second there, I was like, he's really going to try Asar Thompson. And to get that kind of space and put him on ice skates and then hit the shot, dude, that was one of the greatest NBA shots I have ever seen.
Dude, it was absolutely breathtaking in the moment, especially because, as you said, the setup, Asar Thompson changed the game when he came in early in the fourth quarter. They're down 11 points at the time, comes in around the 9:30 mark. And then Brunson, like, he had some more issues against Asar than he did against anybody else, really, in the whole series. And then for Brunson to create against him in that moment, using Thompson's aggression against him for that kind of early step back. He stopped on a dime a little earlier than I think Thompson could have anticipated there. And yeah, that was an absolutely gorgeous shot. Got the double bang from Mike Breen on the local Knicks broadcast on MSG Network. And rightfully so. Like, that was an amazing game for Brunson, and finishing with 40 points. Man, in the Knicks advance here. And what was a awesome series. This is just a straight up fun series to watch. I know there's some missed calls, a lot of controversy, and Pistons fans are going to always remember some of that. But from a pure basketball standpoint, this was a fun series to watch, Tom. I had a great time with every game.
Yeah, it was 90s basketball. It was gritty. It was physical. It was a lot of jawing back and forth. And look at the score in the last four games of this series, all within one possession games. We did a big number this week, Dan Devine. You can catch it on Yahoo Sports and on YouTube. We did a show this week highlighting the fact that there were 11 games this postseason that were decided by 3 points or fewer. And the percentage of those games in the grand scheme of postseason games, That's the highest percentage we've had since 2003 when we went to a seven-game first-round series. We've been getting a ton of those games, close games. The Knicks had four straight to finish this series of one-possession games, and they've been all super close, tons of lead changes, and you're just on the edge of your seat for the entire game. So many swings back and forth. And you said it on X last night, and I really agreed with your take. I was like, why are you taking Asar Thompson out of the game down the stretch, considering all the work that he had done to Jalen Brunson? And I get it. He's not a three-point threat, and Dennis Schroeder is a little bit better from downtown, gives you a little bit more stretch. But the size factor and the way that he had just really stopped Jalen Brunson, people are going to say that final play, look what he did to him on his final play. The 90% of the other plays in this series, Thompson had the upper hand. And I just felt like this was a really close game, and I thought it was a disservice to Thompson and to all the work that he did, that he was pulled down the stretch. I just thought it was a big mistake by Jimmy Bickerstaff.
I mean, look, Bickerstaff had a horrible series, I thought, and a horrible closing game six as well, because, you know, there's a couple things here. A, Asar Thompson, you know, as great as he was defensively in this series, you got him in this game, he plays 23 minutes in a must win or go home game six, he plays 23 minutes. Malik Beasley, obviously, he fumbled the last pass. He made a mistake in the final moments as well. But here's this guy who, arguably the sixth man of the year, loses it to Pritchard, but an integral player to your success. he doesn't play over 30 minutes on average in the series. Like, why are you not playing your best players more minutes in a playoff series here in a matchup in which you need their production? And in that moment with Ausar Thompson in the fourth quarter, Tom, I just can't figure out any reason at all why you would sub Ausar out of that game. You're down 11 points when you put Thompson in at the 9:30 mark. You take him out at the 3:50 mark, up five, with him doing a hell of a job on Brunson, better than anybody else on the roster did. Why are you taking him out? A couple minutes later, you bring him in. You know, people are saying, well, is it for rest? Did he ask for a breather? No. No, second year, Ausar Thompson did not ask for a breather in the fourth quarter of a must-win game. And even if he did, you tell him to get back out there. That's what you do if you're J.B. Bickerstaff. But he didn't ask for it. After the game, he's asked about it, and he didn't really have an answer. It's like, oh, must have, you know, he's asked, was this about scheme or rest? And Ausar's like, I don't know, maybe it was like scheme or something like that. But he looked crushed in the moment, and obviously he would be after Brunson destroyed him on the last play. But if you're J.B. Bickerstaff, you're not playing your best players enough. This happened in Cleveland after years and years and years with X's and O's issues down the stretch of games, bad decisions down the stretch of games, bad subs, and then it happens in Detroit. And I think, Tom, I was in the right to leave J.B. Bickerstaff off the top three of my Coach of the Year ballot. I know a lot of people had him there. I think I was in the right considering the Pistons' struggles this year against top 10 teams. Where I may have been in the wrong was putting Cade Cunningham as my most improved player of the year. Because this is a rough series for him in some of these final stretches. He had this poor offhand layup that he clanked off the backboard.
Smoked it.
My God, horrible. He didn't shoot well from three either. He looked like he lost confidence in his dribble jumper over the course of the series. Cade Cunningham showed how far he still needs to go, I thought, in the series as well.
17% shooting in the series from downtown for Cade Cunningham. And if a couple of those go in, like, this is the Pistons winning the series. So that's the difference, right? When the margins are this slim, four of the final games of this series were decided by 3 points or fewer. And if he hits just one or two of those, this is a different series and they're going to game seven. And they possibly have already finished the series, right? The other thing I want to point out, to go back to J.B. Bickerstaff real quick, Malik Beasley wasn't in the game for 9 straight minutes at the end of that game. He subs him in for that one possession and he flubs the pass just like Gary Trent Jr. did the other night. And you ask yourself, how could he do that? How could Malik Beasley in that moment drop the pass, has an amazing play drawn up by J.B. Bickerstaff, gets that open shot at the end, and you see Malik Beasley drop the pass? Well, why did he do that? Because he was on ice for 9 minutes. He got taken out of the game at the 9:19 mark in the fourth quarter, benched the entire fourth quarter, and then, hey, dude, hey, we need you for this, the most important possession of our season. We need you out here. I'm not saying that he should have dropped that pass based on the fact that he was riding pine for the entire fourth quarter. I'm saying that was quite a decision by J.B. Bickerstaff to hold Malik Beasley out of the game, and then when he's cold, go in and hit the game-winning shot. That was a tough ask by J.B. Bickerstaff and a lot of controversial substitution patterns there. I don't know what the coach's fascination is with Dennis Schroeder. I mean, coaches love this guy. And he goes from team to team, postseason to postseason. And I just think he's undersized. And I just think a lot of the antics don't work in big moments. And I just felt like I wanted Malik Beasley and Tim Hardaway Jr. out there a lot more, and Ausar Thompson a lot more than they did down the stretch. And look, who was the number one guy on the team in net rating when he was on the floor? What player had the best net rating on the floor? It was Thompson. And this guy should have been there down the stretch. I don't see why you have anyone else other than Thompson out there in clutch moments. And Malik Beasley, it was a terrible, terrible play by Beasley at the end there. But dude, the guy was on the bench for the entire fourth quarter. That's why.
It Ausar Thompson in the series, 22.7 minutes per game. And for Malik Beasley, 9 minutes straight in the fourth is absurd. Like you said, Tom, it doesn't excuse him fumbling the pass, but only 27.3 minutes per game in the series for Malik Beasley. And for Beasley, it wasn't his best series. He had some stinker shooting performances. He only shot 33.9% from three in the entire series, but he was 6 for 13 in that game six. He was having a hot night from three, and to lose him in that fourth quarter basically the entire time is a mistake in my opinion. And for the Knicks here, Tom, they have an upcoming series against the Celtics after having a war against the Pistons with a ton of these close games. And now they have to go into Boston with game one on Monday night, game two next Wednesday. So they have a little bit of rest this weekend, but not as much as time as Boston's had to prepare for this series. So what are your early expectations of this series between the Celtics and the Knicks?
Knicks Pistons was in standard definition, SD. This one's going to be in 4K. This series is going to be a modern NBA series compared to what we just saw with the Detroit Pistons. That's not a three-point slinging team. Like you saw down the stretch, like Malik Beasley was not on the floor. And he's maybe the best three-point shooter outside of Stephen Curry in the league. And Jimmy Bickerstaff was like, nah, we prefer to grind this out and have grinders, more throwback players on the floor in this series. This is not going to be the same series at all. Boston swept the Knicks in the regular season. Three of those games were blowouts. Close one there in April, just a couple weeks ago, in overtime when Porzingis was hot down the stretch. I do think that this is going to be a five-game series. Boston, I think, is going to make quick work of the New York Knicks. Jalen Brunson's heroics down the stretch covered up and masked a lot of problems offensively for the New York Knicks. The fact that they do not have offensive chemistry, and we talked about it on Thursday's show on The Big Number, this offense, without Jalen Brunson hitting those clutch shots, it's a mess. It's a mess. And the Boston Celtics, I think the defense that they provide, the drive and kick, the five different weapons on the floor that they can employ and have all this versatility. I think Tom Thibodeau and the Knicks that are still playing a lot of 90s basketball, I think it's going to be a rude wake-up call. I think it's Celtics in five.
Yeah, I'd say Celtics in five as well. I'll give the Knicks one, you know, because of Brunson, some of their talent level, their ability to have a really hot shooting night as well, and maybe Boston goes cold one night as well. But ultimately, you know, the Knicks assembled this team for this series against the Celtics. And you were supposed to feel like going into a second round or conference finals matchup between Boston and New York that they'd actually have a shot. And before the season, I was on Knicks Fan TV with CP the Franchise, and I said to him, I was like, you know, the Knicks, I do feel like they have a chance. Boston isn't some unbeatable juggernaut like the KD Warriors, where you feel like, okay, there's nothing we can do. But after the full season, well, no, I don't think the Knicks might have much of a chance. I feel like this team has a lot of missing pieces. Mikal Bridges has not been what I thought he could be for them, and that's a big reason why. And Karl Anthony Towns, Jalen Brunson, there's still holes on defense as well that you can attack with their best players. And Boston, with what Joe Mazzulla loves to call their killer whale offense, he's going to attack the seal on the other side, and that's Brunson and Kat over and over. So I struggle to find reasons why I think, okay, the Knicks could actually pull this out. And the only real one is that Boston, like Tatum falls off a cliff, Brown falls off a cliff. But even then, KP could have a huge series. Derek White could have a huge series. There's other guys on Boston with their amount of depth. But I really struggle to find ways the Knicks could win. If they do win the series, what went right for them, Tom?
Well, it's the offense. If they can get that offense back to where it was in the first half of the season, after the All-Star break, the Knicks offense ranked 22nd in the NBA, bottom 10 offense for the second half of the season. And then this postseason, they're 11th out of 16. So when you look at the offense, if they can figure out a better way to employ Karl Anthony Towns and win that matchup against KP, who used to play for the Knicks, it's going to be a big storyline for this series is Kristaps Porzingis going against his former team at Madison Square Garden. I think it's going to be great, great theater in this series for like two games. And then I think the Celtics are just going to dominate the rest of the way. Because like, dude, Kev, the offense, the way that you build a five-out offense with those players, OG Anunoby, Kat, Josh Hart, Jalen Brunson, you want to space the floor and have attacking lanes, drive lanes, and spread the floor and hit from downtown. But they're not utilizing it in any way near the same fashion that the Boston Celtics in the second half of the year was. I had 122 points per 100 possessions, and the Knicks were at 110. They're just totally two different stratospheres when it comes to how they employ that five-out system and have five shooters out there. Tom Thibodeau, look, man, this is going to be a huge series for him. There's a lot of history between him and the Knicks. Obviously, he was under Jeff Van Gundy for that 99 finals run. I was thinking about this the other day, like that Jalen Brunson shot, where does it rank all time in Knicks history? And I think it's probably, I'm probably going to put it third, maybe the four-pointer by LJ against the Indiana Pacers to win that game in the Eastern Conference semis. That's probably the biggest shot. Then you got Allen Houston. And then, you know, maybe Jalen Brunson's shot goes number two. But the Larry Johnson four-point play is probably number one on there. And you know who Larry Johnson credits for that four-point play? It's Tom Thibodeau. Because Tom Thibodeau infused all of this belief in Larry Johnson. He only had 4 points in the first game against Indiana earlier in that series. And he says later on, he was like, the guy who it like gave me all of this belief that I could go out there and hit that shot, it was Tom Thibodeau, who was the top assistant for Jeff Van Gundy during that Knicks series. So there's a lot of storylines here, but it's going to have to come from more innovative offense that isn't just coming from Jalen Brunson. Karl-Anthony Towns, he's got to average like 30 points a game, I think. If they're going to win this series, he's got to have the series of his life.
You're basically asking for something that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. You're not going to install that offense at this point in the second round of the playoffs, unfortunately, even though they should have done that a long time ago. The other game on Thursday night, Tom, Clippers beat the Nuggets 111 to 105 to extend the series to a game seven this Saturday, which will be in Denver. I'm excited for this one, Tom. I've been a flip-flopper with this series throughout. I after the Clippers blew out the Nuggets early in the series, I think I said to you, I regret not picking the Clippers sooner because MPJ's out. Looks like the Nuggets are falling apart. Kawhi looks amazing, this and that. And then the Nuggets swing it the other way. And Murray looks like he's back. And MPJ looks restored. And Aaron Gordon has an amazing moment with the putback dunk. And he'll win the game and everything. And here we are. We're at game seven, just like basically everybody thought we would be entering the series, even though we got here in this weird, long and winding road. But here we are, and the number one thing on my mind entering this game seven is Jokic's struggles down the stretch of this series, because in that game six, in the second half, 5 points in the second half for Jokic on 2 of 9 shooting. And for the entire series in the fourth quarter, he's averaging only 3.8 points per game on 36.4% from the field, only 20% from three. This is abnormal for Jokic. And we saw in that game five, they can win games with Jokic not having big nights. Jamal Murray can go off. Other guys can have good games. But something does seem off with Jokic in this series, Tom, and I do worry about that for Denver, but maybe the former multi-time MVP, former finals MVP shows up and shows why he's an all-timer in this game seven. But that is the number one thing on my mind with what's up with Jokic in these endgame situations.
Yeah, did you hear what he said after the game about Nick Batum? He was like, man, Nick Batum, that guy, much better shooter than Chris Dunn. Ty Lue makes that switch.
He straight up said that. Mm-hmm. Better than Chris Dunn. And he's right. Like, it took until game six, but Ty Lue finally did it. 10 minutes. You're awesome on defense, but you're hurting our offense. Time for Batum.
And I'm wondering, like, Jokic, what he said after the game, Kev, like, is Ty Lue now going to be like, all right, Nick Batum, let's go. Like, this is how it's going to be. He guarded Jokic very well in this game. And Zoo is, I think, I've said it here last week, I think Zoo is the best Jokic defender in the league. And you're seeing when they switch up a little bit with Harden and then in game six with Nick Batum, he was awesome. I feel like we need like an appreciation day for Nick Batum and his like kind of second act in his NBA career. The work that he did in Paris and the Netflix documentary that showed just how vocal this dude and how passionate he is about winning basketball games and for his home country in France. But also just at this age, what Nick Batum is doing, we talk a lot about Chris Paul and he played 82 games this year and Steph Curry and LeBron, but we need to give some love to Nick Batum and what he's doing at this stage of his career. Amazing defensive plays, a much better threat from downtown offensively than Chris Dunn, and that opens up a lot of things, a lot of avenues for Norm Powell to go at the cup and James Harden. I don't think it's a coincidence that we saw the Norm Powell game in a game in which Nick Batum was out on the floor, because he is just a much better option offensively and gives you a lot more weapons offensively. And you said Nick Batum MVP. I missed this post from you. But dude, what an awesome, awesome final act for Nick Batum. Like, we need to give this dude his flowers.
I forget who said it on the broadcast, but like, he went from defending Jokic to defending Murray, and he's banging down threes. He's making connective passes. Batum's been an awesome, he's had so many different stages of his career. Earlier in his career with Charlotte, more of a scorer type, but then he became this elite, elite role player. And the fact he's still doing it at this point, at this age, at 36, and I think, what was his first time all season playing over 30 minutes in a game as well? It's crazy, Tom. But I mean, he's integral to the series. His rising role in this series is part of the reason why the Clippers have been able to push this to a seven, and why it didn't end early, because it wasn't working with Dunn. Dunn is awesome defensively. He brings great intangibles, but the way in which the Nuggets were giving him, you know, the Russell Westbrook treatment, sagging off of him, Dunn wasn't making them pay in ways that Russ has in spots this series. And so Lou, it took him a little bit to get there, but made the right decision. And as you said, Batum, it's not just the scoring, it's also the defense on Jokic. He's another guy who plays him hard, and I think that's part of it with Joker right now. Zubac does a great job. Batum does a good job. They're throwing occasional doubles earlier in the series when it was Simmons, or when it's Harden occasionally. They're throwing two at Jokic. It feels like they're mixing up so many different coverages against Joker. And I also do wonder if fatigue's a factor too. He doesn't look quite right to me in a lot of these situations. And also, you know, I'm not going to critique, you know, me in my armchair, critique one of the greatest offensive players ever, Tom, but he passed on some jumpers. You know, it's like you've become a 45% guy from three. Take that shot more. You know, tap into your inner Steph instead of driving into some of these heavily contested shots in the lane, especially late in the game. He passed on some jumpers I thought he should have taken.
Yeah, and look, like, you're getting great Russell Westbrook games here and there. You got to win those games. If you're getting like good Russell Westbrook games, you got to get the victory, because they're not going to come around very often when he's at this stage of his career, right? And Jokic has to have a higher usage rate. He has to have like a 40-point game here. And I know that's I feel like I'm talking like Shaq and when he talks about Dwight Howard, but it's true. Like, Jokic with this roster and Michael Porter Jr. is giving him nothing. Like, his shoulder issues, he's got like that Kobe Bryant rap on him, like in the game, where it looks like, man, what is he dealing with right now?
He gave him something in games 4 and 3. Like, so he had like a moment where I was like, oh, wait a minute, is he okay? And then he looked like nothing again in game 6.
The guy is one of the great off-ball cutters in the league. He's one of the top wing cut guys in the league. If you look at the numbers, you watch Synergy, and you're like, he's not just a three-point shooter. Like, this guy is a adept cutter off the ball, where he's able to leverage his height and his ability to play off of Jokic, but he's not doing that in this series. And I think part of it is because he's afraid of contact. He's afraid of having to finish at the rim, and he's just not a threat anymore off the ball if he's not at the perimeter. And so that's a big reason why I think Jokic has to have like 25 shots in game 7 and have one of these all-time performances, because otherwise either leaning on a banged up Aaron Gordon and Jamal Murray, it's just going to take one of these amazing all-time performances from Jokic, because I just think that they don't have the bodies right now. And James Harden, he tires down the stretch. Typically, as the series progresses, his effectiveness goes way down, and he's older, obviously, than he's ever been before. So I think Kawhi Leonard, James Harden, and Nikola Jokic, we're going to see this kind of championship medal that we've seen from Kawhi Leonard and Nikola Jokic. Which one is going to come up bigger? Because I don't think you're going to get it from James Harden. I think it's going to come down to Jokic and Kawhi, who both have finals MVPs under their belt.
Tom, do we know which day game 1 is going to be for next round with OKC? Monday or Tuesday?
Not sure on that.
Yeah, I don't think that's out quite yet, but either way, that's tough for Denver or LA, with OKC having over a week off, like, you can get enough prep for both of these teams and rest. Maybe it's too much rest. That's the only thing.
There is a point. Statistically, there is a point where there's like it's too much rest, and I just don't think
especially
OKC,
after the first round with blowouts almost every game, except for one of them. Maybe too much rest. Yeah. That's the only counter argument there. A couple weeks.
Yeah, did
off,
they go
really.
To Cancun? I don't think they're going to Cancun. This OKC team seems like they just went to OKC and played video games, right? Like that's what they did.
Yeah, but either way, like after this hell of a series between the Nuggets and Clippers, then you have to face the Thunder on limited rest. That's really tough. We got a game 6 tonight, Tom, between the Rockets and the Warriors. I'm hoping for a game 7 with this one, man. I picked Houston at 6. That is not going to happen. But I remain hopeful for a game 7 here, Tom. Am I going to be disappointed tonight on Friday?
I think this is a team, the Warriors, that were just wanting to play at Chase Center again. Like that game 5 performance was awful. They laid down. It was like they knew that they had a game to play with. You know, like maybe we want to win this back at Golden State at home because defensively, it was zero effort. Everything that Houston wanted, they got. And I just think that they knew they were playing with house money here, being up 3-1 in the series. And so they go back to Golden State. Steph gets a little bit more rest and recovery for his injured finger, his thumb. And what we're seeing, I can't believe he did this, but Dylan Brooks straight up admitted after the game that he's trying to injure Steph Curry. And like, this isn't gamesmanship anymore. This isn't just like, you know, a bulletin board material, or this is just like guys who are trying to, you know, get inside someone else's head. Like Dylan Brooks is straight up trying to weaponize his hand and knock Steph Curry out of the game. I don't think it's good form. I don't think, like, maybe he can do it and not admit it afterwards, but something about that bothered me where it was like, I think players will instinctively want to go at someone's hurt ankle, like he said, or, you know, put pressure on a knee. If a guy's got a banged up knee, run up and down the floor, try to run them out of the gym, hit them on cuts. But to like swing at the greatest shooter ever, his hand, because it's injured and it's swollen to a pineapple, that feels like it's over the edge. What'd you think about that?
So what Brooks said exactly was, if someone had an injured ankle, I would tack that ankle every single time. So whatever they're saying on the broadcast, they can keep saying it. Is that the quote that you had in mind?
That's the one I'm referring to, where it's like, okay, he's like, if I had a hurt ankle, like, yeah, I'm going to go at that ankle. And like the implication here is he didn't deny it. He never once said like, oh, dude, I'm just trying to contest the shot. Like, I'm not trying to hurt Stephen Curry. He was like, yeah, you know what? I expect if I had a hurt ankle, people would try to go at it too.
I mean, to me, it feels like a football player thing is what it sounds like. It's like a defensive lineman going after an offensive lineman with like a hurt left elbow. And you might smack at that elbow when you're trying to attack the quarterback on the way, just to try to get him a little bit more injured, a little bit more hurt. It feels like an NFL thing, not an NBA thing. It's not often you hear stuff players openly admit things like that, to your point, Tom. And it's no surprise watching the games. Like, you almost don't even need him to say it to know.
I know.
That's what Brooks is going
wild
for.
Dude. There was one where he was like 3 swipes after Steph Curry took the shot. It was like he took 3 jabs at his wrist and the ball was already at the rim. It was nuts.
Did you see the photo of Steph? It's Steph's hand, like without the bandage on it. Did you see it? It's like a little golf ball in like his thumb. It's crazy looking how big that is, and he's still shooting like crazy with it.
I'd be laid up for 3 weeks in bed if I had a wrist that looked like that.
I can't write. It hurts the
look, tight. Kev, I can't get on the mic. Like, I have to tighten my mic here in order to get it, go on the show. Look, I can't give it a go. That's how I would be. And Steph Curry's still like, oh, here's another 30 piece for you. I think this Rockets Warriors series is a lot of fun, but the way that Giannis and KD and those storylines are hanging over this series, I can't help myself but watch the Houston Rockets offense and just wonder what it would be like if they had a go-to scorer that could pierce the defense routinely and have a lot of gravity. Jalen Green, he can have that for a game or two in a series, but consistently having this gravitational pull on a single player, they don't have that guy yet. And I wonder if the Golden State Warriors coming out in game six with Draymond Green hearing what Dylan Brooks said, I wonder if they're going to come out with a little bit more bravado. And I'm not saying he's going to come out and try to hurt Dylan Brooks, but I think they're going to try to send a message here in game six.
Well, let's talk about that right now then, Tom, because on Get Up on Friday morning, Brian Windhorst went on ESPN and talked about how two teams are the teams to watch for Giannis Antetokounmpo. Of course, the Bucks were outed in the first round. They're done in a heartbreaking loss, just disastrous loss. And here we are. Windhorst says the Rockets and Spurs are the two teams to watch for Giannis Antetokounmpo. And he was referencing in part how both these teams are in the draft lottery. The Rockets own the Suns pick, which has a 17.3% chance of moving into the top four, a 3.8% chance of going to number one. The Spurs are one spot ahead of that with their own pick, a 26.3% chance of going into the top four, a 6% chance of going to the number one pick for the opportunity to get Cooper Flagg. And Wendy's saying, A, those teams need a star. B, they have an immediate asset with this year's first round pick. If that moves up, it dramatically increases their odds. And no surprises here, in my opinion, because if you look logically at what teams could have the assets for Giannis, what teams have a need for Giannis, what teams could fill the needs of the Bucks with, and I'm the Milwaukee Bucks, I'll tell you what, Tom, I'm not trading Giannis unless I get back my picks in 26 and 27 from the Pelicans. I'm not trading Giannis unless I get those back. So that would require a team that has enough assets to make it a three-way deal to flip something to New Orleans to get my own picks back. There's no reason to trade Giannis otherwise unless I control my own destiny the next 2 years, especially next year in what is a loaded 2026 NBA draft, way better than 2025, especially at the top of the draft. There are multiple Cooper Flags next year, not just one Cooper Flag, okay? So that's what I want if I'm the Bucks. The Spurs and the Rockets are the two teams that can do that with the amount of picks and young guys they have. To your point about Houston, I can't watch this series either without thinking about it because we see what it looks like when a star appears because Jalen Green goes from looking like a dud to this megastar scorer out of nowhere. And when he's scoring 38 points early in the series, it's like, oh, this is what the Rockets look like when they have an elite defense and they have a star scorer. If you add like Giannis to the mix with his ability to create buckets and defend, not on the last play against Tyrese Halliburton driving right, it changes everything about what this Houston Rockets team could possibly be. My question is this, though, for you, Tom. If you're Houston, would you be willing to give up Alperen Şengün in a trade for Giannis Antetokounmpo, or are you trying to avoid that at all costs and give up picks, other players? But if Milwaukee wants Şengün, are you willing to do that?
Yeah, I think I am because I don't love the fit between Şengün and Giannis. Şengün's not a floor spacer. Jabari Smith is. And I know that the Milwaukee Bucks are going to want that guy, Jabari Smith and Reed Shepard and all of the picks. They want to build a team for the long haul. They want to rebuild, right? They don't necessarily look. Alperen Şengün is already an all-star, but he's going to get paid like one too. So this isn't a case where you're able to just get guys on their rookie scale contracts and build down the line. Alperen Şengün is good enough that you're not going to be a number one pick next year if he's on your team. Like, he's already a star. He's a foundational piece that can win you 40 games, and with the right pieces around him, he's good enough right now for the Milwaukee Bucks to kind of be in that purgatory, to be in that kind of the hamster wheel of mediocrity where you're going to want to, if you're going down this path of rebuilding, you're going to want to be at the very bottom of the standings. I think Şengün is a little too good for that. But I also think the Houston Rockets have enough assets that there's going to be a platter, not a poo-poo platter, it's much better than that, a platter of options for a team like the Milwaukee Bucks to choose from.
What's wrong with a poo-poo platter? Much better than that. What's wrong with a poo-poo platter?
I know.
I love an appetizer, a little medley there. Come on.
I don't know. I feel like the metaphor is usually used for like the fecal matter, not necessarily for the actual poo-poo platter is delicious. What I'm getting at, Kev, is that Reed Sheppard, Amend Thompson, I don't think Amend Thompson, Tim McMahon's reporting over at ESPN is that there's one untouchable guy on the Houston Rockets roster, and it's Amend Thompson. Don't think he's going to be put into a deal, but there's so many options and directions that Milwaukee could go to. And I think it's going to take a three-way deal. I think when you look at, or a four-way deal, if you look at what the Milwaukee Bucks want is getting their picks back, obviously either from Portland or New Orleans in the Damian Lillard trade. You got New Orleans, thankfully for the Milwaukee Bucks, I think the new ownership or the front office there in New Orleans with Joe Dumars and Troy Weaver, they're going to be a lot more motivated than, say, I think David Griffin would be if they were going to make a trade and get on the phone. I think this new front office is going to be motivated to kind of clean house and make a trade in their own image. What they want is their own team. And I think when you got Joe Dumars and you got Troy Weaver on the other side of that phone, yeah, you're going to be fielding calls to make a splash. And I think you're going to see a lot more conversation around the name Zion Williamson going forward this offseason than we did before Giannis was looking at, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Fresh Prince standing in that living room all by himself and looking around and saying, what franchise am I going to have? I think New Orleans is going to be maybe the most interesting franchise this summer because of their ability not only to get Cooper Flagg, but to kind of facilitate a Giannis Antetokounmpo trade. And I will say this too. This is exactly what I was advocating for with Wemby and the San Antonio Spurs when they traded for De'Aaron Fox. You have a two-year window right now where Wemby is being paid like Max Strus. He's going to get paid next season. Wemby is going to get paid $13 million, and the season after that, $16 million. This is your window to acquire a Giannis or to acquire another superstar and go for it. And so for the San Antonio Spurs, I love the mentality. If they are truly in the sweepstakes for Giannis Antetokounmpo, I love it. Like, go for it now with the Oklahoma City Thunder trying to arm up before they're in their peak form. I think this is the window. You want to get Giannis, perfect complement to Victor Wembanyama and the three-point spacing that he offers. Imagine trying to go against Giannis and Wemby, two unicorns of unicorns defensively, and you got that inside-out game with Wemby and Giannis. I love it. I would love to see him in a San Antonio Spurs uniform.
My prediction, Tom, is the Spurs get Giannis. They have all the pieces. They have all the draft picks. They have the tradable young guys. They could give up Castle if they wanted. They could give more picks instead if they wanted to. They have all the pieces that make sense to go get Giannis. They also have the motivation, to your point, with Wemby's contract situation. They have the past actions that show they're starting to press the accelerator by trading for Fox at the trade deadline. They now still have more than enough assets with future Atlanta picks, future Boston picks, their own future picks. They have so many different assets in the years to come that will give them the ability to go get another guy. And as I said, they have the guy who won Rookie of the Year in Castle as well, among other appealing young players, to put together a really, really strong package. And they also have the roster that would appeal to Giannis as well. If you're Giannis Antetokounmpo, you see what the Spurs could be on paper with Victor Wembanyama and De'Aaron Fox. You're not going to some proven team that's done it before, where there's already an established foundation. You're going to a franchise where you can be a part of building it again, just like you were part of it with Milwaukee. You're going to an organization where if you win one or two or three or four, not to sound like LeBron James, if you go there, you could have a statue in two places, in Milwaukee and in San Antonio. And I think, you know, Houston can offer little bits of that as well with the foundation there, but you know, a lot of these other teams that people talk about as Giannis teams, I don't think they have enough assets. It's tougher to work salary-wise with finances. And for the Bucks, I just don't see why you do it. I just don't see why you would do it unless Giannis forces things and it gets ugly and messy and it's a disgusting breakup. And I don't think that's going to happen. This is not sourced. It's just my gut feeling. I don't think this is going to get ugly. I think if it's a breakup this summer, it'll be a cleaner breakup between Giannis and the Bucks. I don't think it's going to get ugly like a lot of these do. I think it'll be clean, which is why Rockets and Spurs to me are the obvious destinations. Windy seems to think so as well. And I continue to feel that way increasingly, Tom. And I can't get it off my mind watching this postseason, like you can't either.
Yeah, yeah. Who is Milwaukee more interested in acquiring in this? Is it Reed Sheppard and, say, Jabari Smith? Or is it Stephon Castle? Because if you're Milwaukee, you're going to want those guys to build around. To me, I want Reed Sheppard. I think he's the guy. Steph Castle's also awesome, but in terms of the excitement factor and the ability to kind of transform the franchise, I would love to see what Reed Sheppard would do if the franchise was built around him.
Well, Castle's proven more so far, but I
sure.
think
like, you it's and not I agree, a high bar.
But you and I agree that we'd still keep Reed ahead of him in a redraft. I would wonder what John Horst, who was extended as Bucks GM, who he had first on his board ahead of those guys. Ahead of Castle or Reed, whoever he had ahead, I'm sure is who he prefers. The team that eliminated the Bucks from the first round, the Indiana Pacers, they have their first round series against the Cleveland Cavaliers on Sunday. It's very possible that series is starting at the same time or before a game 7 between the Rockets and the Warriors. If that series gets extended tonight, it's always weird with the series overlap. Tom, I think this is going to be a fun series. I think it's going to be a fun up and down series. Indiana is going to continue to show why they've been kind of underwatched, underdiscussed over this entire series. With that said, I think they're running into a team in Cleveland that is just starting to click once again, like they did earlier in the season. And I would expect it to go 5, possibly 6. Am I underestimating the Pacers again, just like I did in the first round against the Bucks?
Yeah, it's going to come down to Tyrese Haliburton, right? Like the Cavs don't have this lockdown defender that they can throw at Haliburton in the backcourt. You might see Evan Mobley on there, DeAndre Hunter, but I don't know what Tyrese Haliburton we're going to get. Because this guy, like if he's the 26-point, 9-assist dude who took it to Giannis in the final possession in that game, like this is going to be a series. But this is a guy who started out slow against the Milwaukee Bucks and has a tendency to play Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. This season, one of the biggest yo-yo players in the league, very inconsistent, didn't know which Hallie we were going to get. If we're going to get all-NBA dude who has confidence in his three-point shot, who has the ability to get not just 30 points, but also 15 assists and no turnovers, that's peak Tyrese Haliburton. If we get that guy who's able to put pressure on a defense that doesn't have an Amen Thompson, doesn't have a Tamani Kamara, doesn't have a dude who you can throw at a Tyrese Haliburton.
Tom, they got Dean Wade. They got DeAndre Hunter. They got Max Strus. They got wing defenders, though. They have guys with length and size. They don't have that elite, quote-unquote, guard stopper, but they do have a lot of wings. That's what they try to go out and get. They have Isaac Okoro. They do have options at the wing spot.
You have more confidence in them as lockdown defenders than I do. But I think the Tyrese Haliburton, they're going to go at Tyrese.
Not lockdown defenders, but they have bodies. They have good bodies at the wing spot.
I think it's Cavs in 5. I'm just saying, if it's going to be the Pacers are going to make it interesting, it's got to come from Tyrese Haliburton and the gravity that he has. And so, Nembhard, all these, the supporting cast, TJ McConnell, I'm not worried about them. I think the ability for them to make this a series is going to all rely on Tyrese Haliburton, because it's kind of like the Luka LeBron Lakers in the sense that, like, the way that they were going to win that series against Minnesota is if they were going to be able to outscore the opponents and be able to cover up defensive liabilities and just outscore everybody. The way that the Indiana Pacers are going to make this series is if Tyrese Haliburton can be a huge plus offensively and mask himself defensively enough to float against this Cavaliers team that has just been mowing opponents down all year. And as I said it on Thursday's show, The only time that we've seen the 4 stars on Cleveland play the 2 stars on Indiana this season is 8 minutes. That's all we've had. So you can kind of throw out the regular season and the way that they played in the regular season, because we just have not seen these two teams at their best going at it.
No, we haven't at all yet. And I mean, look, I think the series is going to be a good one. I think you hit the nail on the head, though, with Tyrese Haliburton. he reminds me in some ways of an earlier version of Jokic, where you have this savant passer who undeniably makes his teammates better. Like, he makes his teammates better as a playmaker. But with Jokic earlier in his career, there were times you'd watch him and be like, why'd you take two shots tonight? Why didn't you play more aggressively in the fourth quarter? Why did you not take a shot in the whole first half? Like, we need you to score, dude. You can't just be a passer. Mm. And that's the way I feel certain nights with Haliburton, where it's like, dude, you can create your shot at any moment. Like, we need you to average 20 shots per game in the playoffs. And, you know, they didn't need it from him against the Bucks. Obviously, he gave it to them in their closeout game against Milwaukee, game five. But I think he's going to have to be that guy every single night, every night of this entire series against the Cleveland Cavaliers. And otherwise, it'll probably be a quicker one than Indiana Pacers fans are probably expecting, Tom. We got breaking news, Tom. Greg Popovich no longer going to be the head coach of the San Antonio Spurs, and he's transitioning to team president, according to Shams Charania. This just dropped just now, not to interrupt you. Wow. 76 years old. Wow. We were literally just talking about who could be the next coach of the Spurs, and this just dropped just now. Wow.
Yeah, that's end of an era. I hope that this is a sign that Greg Popovich is at peace both with his career and his accomplishments. I would call him the greatest NBA coach of all time. The fact that he's being transitioned full time to team president, it tells me that like the medical prognosis is better, that they feel like he can work in some capacity with the organization. But this is a real this is a sad day for the NBA that it had to go out this way with Greg Popovich. But man, what an incredible career, coaching career from Pop. And I know that this guy does not want a goodbye tour where he is just out there and getting cheers from the visiting teams or cheers in every arena. Like, he is not doing a farewell tour in the NBA. That's not his DNA. That's not who he is. And so for him, that he's whether this was a mutual decision, I'm not seeing that in Charania's report, whether this was his call or the organization call. But it does seem like to me that Greg Popovich wouldn't even want that, a farewell tour a la Kobe Bryant or someone like that, even though he meant that much to this game. Greg Popovich, salute to you, sir, on an amazing head coaching career.
Shams wrote that Popovich has been involved every day as a vital member of the franchise's day-to-day operation. But as much as he wanted to return to his place on the sidelines, he came to the conclusion that he no longer could move forward with the taxing grind of being an NBA head coach, sources told Shams Charania. So, you know, Shams also adds he made great progress in his recovery from his November stroke. But you know, an emotional meeting with and ultimately he determined that this is for the best for his future and for the best of the Spurs. And I mean, look, I think you're right, Tom. One of the greatest coaches in the history of basketball, obviously spanning multiple eras of the game. And for him as a man, it's sad that health in part is what forced him to have to make this decision right now. But hopefully he's at peace with it. Mark Stein says the strong expectation is that Mitch Johnson, who is the intern for Pop this year, will be named his full-time coaching replacement. What's your instant reaction to that?
Yeah, Steve Kerr is not on the board. I think that's what it tells me, is that if it's not Steve Kerr, I don't think that they had a good option outside of the organization for his full-time replacement. So Mitch Johnson, I think, has earned it. I liked what he did in the second half of the season around Wemby, and it's certainly the players buy into him. Chris Paul buys into him. Not that you need to make decisions based on a 40-year-old, but I do think that if he's going to be the head coach going forward, it tells me that some of the bigger name options were not available to them. And certainly Steve Kerr, in the middle of the postseason, I don't think you're going to get him to commit to be the head coach of the San Antonio Spurs. So outside of that, I think that Mitch Johnson was the guy.
The Phoenix Suns. What a mess of a franchise this team is, Tom. Brian Gregory hired above James Jones now to run basketball operations for the Phoenix Suns. Brian Gregory, assistant coach for the Michigan State Spartans back when Matt Ishbia was a player for the Spartans. And Tom, it is becoming a Michigan front office entirely with Matt Ishbia, of course, the owner, Josh Bartlestein from Michigan, Paul Rivers from Michigan, or Orande Talaferro from Michigan. Some of those guys went to Michigan State with or after Matt Ishbia. He's just bringing in everybody. They're becoming the Michigan State Suns, the Phoenix Spartans, whatever you want to call them. That's what they're becoming. And, you know, other guys were fired this week in that Suns front office. Jones transitions to a role. He's getting demoted. They're taking the decision-making away from him. To me, this is a bad sign for Phoenix. It doesn't feel to me that Ishbia has totally learned some lessons with everything that's transpired in recent years. What are your thoughts on it, Tom? Because with Gregory, there's not a lot out there about him with his years in the NBA. It feels like kind of just a, I trust this guy hire for Ishbia and not much else.
No, here's what it is. Here's what this move is all about. Matt Ishbia just hired Matt Ishbia to be the GM. That's all this is. Matt Ishbia got a yes man. He got a guy that goes way back with the Michigan State Tom Izzo tree. Back when he was playing, when he won a championship, Matt Ishbia as a walk-on, who was the assistant coach under Tom Izzo? It was Gregory, right? So when you're looking at why this move was made, I think it has everything to do with Matt Ishbia and him wanting to meddle on all the decisions and have a guy who would say, yeah, whatever you want, sir. Like, you just hired me out of a college basketball career to be the director of player programming last year. His first job in the front office, and now he's the quote-unquote general manager. Like, dude, this reminds me of Michael Jordan hiring Mitch Kupchak, his longtime friend at Carolina, to be the GM on his way out. The only difference is Mitch Kupchak was a very credible and championship-winning executive. There's no experience for this guy, Brian Gregory, in this sort of role. And to me, all this is that Matt Ishbia wants full reins as the decision maker, doesn't want James Jones heavily involved, and he wants to save face by saying, oh, we're transitioning him to be his senior advisor, quote unquote. Please. No, this is all about Matt Ishbia wanting to make the calls there. And so he hires his guy at Michigan State and one of his cronies to do this job. And I think this is all about power. Matt Ishbia wants the power. And I think he is delusional on multiple levels. Talking about Pittsburgh Steelers, he was talking about how the Pittsburgh Steelers are the brand in the NFL that he wants to emulate. And one thing you know about the Pittsburgh Steelers is that they're going to be able to play smash mouth, grind it out, gritty football. Mike Tomlin's been the head coach forever over there. You cycle through a new head coach every single season, and you're saying you want to emulate the Pittsburgh Steelers. He said last year that 26 other GMs would want to have this job at the Phoenix Suns. Out of the 29 other teams in the league, like Matt Ishbia, dude, like this is all about Matt Ishbia. And that's all he wants is to be the guy. And I think this job solidifies that. It cements as Matt Ishbia being the front of this organization. And he hires Brian Gregory in this job because he just wants to be the center of attention.
Unfortunate. It's unfortunate for the Suns. They were in a title. They were in the finals. Felt like they had an opportunity, and it just... it's all gone away, Tom. I mean, it just shows how quickly windows can shut. And, you know, from what I understand for the Suns, there's no clearly defined plan with what they'll do this offseason. I still expect there will be a KD trade. You know, we'll see about Book. But there's no clear definitive plan of what's going to happen this offseason. And I will say this as well. When it comes to Ishbia, I do believe it was real from the sources I've talked to that they went after Bob Myers, that the Suns wanted Bob Myers. It's just, I don't think he wanted the job. or that they were willing to offer the money for the job, whatever the reason may be exactly. And he also seems happy doing what he's doing right now for ESPN on their broadcast and everything else they're doing. But they did want Bob Myers. HBA did want Bob Myers at one point. And so it seems like if you're not getting the best, you know, in HBA's eyes, maybe instead I'm the best option. To your point, Tom, that HBA is just going to take the control here then instead. The Lakers eliminated. I did a full podcast with Nick Wright yesterday diving deep into that, but a lot has still happened since that series ended just a couple days ago with JJ Redick yesterday. Tom, we'll start there, saying we need to get into championship shape. Pretty clear who he's saying this about, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, it's LeBron, right? The guy who spends $1 million a year on his body. By the way, that quote about like LeBron spending $1 million on his body a year, that was like 10 years ago. So like, I feel like we need to go to 10 million now. Like, I feel like that quote needs to be updated to inflation and adjust for how long ago that was when that was running around. It's not about LeBron. This is all about Luka Doncic. It's JJ Redick trying to say to Luka Doncic, look, this is different. We're the Los Angeles Lakers. This is, if you want to win championships, here's just what it's going to take. Championship shape. We know who that quote is about. And I give a lot of kudos to JJ Redick for saying it right off the bat. Hours after they lost in that series, that he's going to go out and set the agenda, which is Luka's got to get in better shape. Question is whether Luka is listening. And that's really going to be the power of Rob Pelinka, Jeannie Buss, LeBron James, and JJ Redick. Is whether they're going to be able to reach Luka Doncic on this level and whether Luka Doncic really cares. Like, we talked to Jason Gallagher over at Basketball Illuminati this week about Luka Doncic. And one of the most revealing stories that he said was when it was asked to Luka Doncic, what's his most biggest shot of his career? Like, his most meaningful shot of his career. Luka Doncic said, oh, there was this this shot before a game. I hit it, a trick shot I hit before the game, and it was just the best shot I've ever had in my career. And it just solidified that this dude, Luka Doncic, is different. Like, the Mamba mentality that Kobe Bryant had and the mold of what Rob Pelinka, Kobe Bryant's agent, long-term agent, it's different with Luka Doncic. And he doesn't have that same sort of disposition. I wonder if the trade humbled him. I wonder if he's going to have and take a new appreciation for not just his diet, but just the off-season regimen. He's a very private dude. We don't know too much about what his off-season habits are or what his off-season regimen is in the same way we know about a lot of different superstars and LeBron James. But that was a very interesting comment from JJ Redick. And he didn't call him out by name, but he pretty much did, right?
Pretty much. Not talking about like LeBron, like you said, or anybody else. But LeBron was in the news on this Friday morning because The Athletic wrote a story saying how, you know, JJ will be back as the head coach. His rookie year as a coach was overall positive. Luka, the Lakers still worry about like, oh, we, you know, until he signs on the dotted line, who knows what the future will be. That's why we were able to get him for cheap. And then there was also this quote. So might James think about finishing his career elsewhere in pursuit of a fifth ring? When posed that question, both league sources close to James and team sources would not rule that possibility out. And that was before the revealing elimination game. That's from The Athletic. Tom, is there any team besides the Cleveland Cavaliers that you think LeBron James would leave the Los Angeles Lakers for?
I don't know. I think it's all about the storyline of going back home and finishing out his career with Cleveland. I think that's what that quote is about. I think LeBron, given that he already went back for nostalgic reasons and for the trying to win a championship for the city of Cleveland, we already know that he cares a lot about Cleveland and Akron and Northeast Ohio. The question for me, Kev, here, is this just another one of these LeBron leverage plays where he's going to have this player option that he can dangle in front of his organization like he has so many times in his career, and the kind of threat of being like, hey, if you don't upgrade at the five, I might just not pick up that player option. I might not sign here. I might not want to be here anymore. That comment after the loss, it's hysterical on like two levels. One, LeBron saying no comment to the question about like roster upgrades at center or whatever, and then he proceeds to comment. And the other is like he has to figure out a way to have leverage against his team to, you know, do things at his command in a way that like he's still 40 years old and still playing at a high level, and he wants to have that power and leverage over his front office. And he saw, I don't think it's a coincidence that Anthony Davis, a clutch client, was not able to stay long term after he said, like, I think I want to play at the five, and LeBron James saying a week later he was gone. I think that was instructive. I think LeBron is still feeling like he's not getting his way, or Clutch or Rich Paul is getting his way. And I think he's trying to find leverage in ways that he can get that five, that spacing, that lob threat five, someone like Daniel Gafford and Derek Lively. I did five trade targets in a column this week over at Yahoo Sports. And I think that's what it was all about, is LeBron James trying to find leverage to get that guy that will make not just him life easier so he doesn't have to play the five, but also Luka Doncic.
Look, I mean, Pelinka is in Laker Luka mode here. I think it's all about Luka, more so than LeBron. If LeBron were to leave, obviously that's a loss for the Lakers. But this is all about building around Luka at this point. You know, Pelinka might say it's for LeBron, but it's really for the long term with Luka Doncic here, with their priorities here. That's why they reversed the Mark Williams trade, because they're thinking long term. It's why this offseason they're going to try to make an acquisition, obviously, that helps in the short term and long term. But it's really about optimizing Luka, and Dallas knows the formula. Lob guys who can protect the rim on defense but offer verticality around the basket. The one interesting thing about that, though, is Pelinka and his presser this week did say, you know, we're also look for stretch guys that protect the rim as well. Miles Turner has always been linked to the Pacers, up to the Lakers for years. They've never got him, but he is an unrestricted free agent this offseason, so maybe that's who he's talking about. Could be Miles Turner, but I would expect the Lakers are going to look for somebody that's the long-term center for Luka. And if LeBron decided, hey, I want to go to Cleveland, if Cleveland loses to the Pacers or gets destroyed by Boston in the East Finals, I'm not totally sold that Cleveland should or would trade for LeBron. I'm just not, like, at his age right now, Tom. Like, part of me, if I'm in that Cavs front office, I want to do it without him. Is that wrong of me to feel that way if I'm a Cavs fan, or like in the Cavs front office?
I think in like 2 years, like you give two runs with this core before you make a deal like that. I think just the you owe it to Kenny Atkinson and Donovan Mitchell, Jared Allen, Evan Mobley, and Darius Garland, and the city of Cleveland to try to give this a run, a real run, for at least 2 years with this core before you bring in LeBron. But I do think that there's a real like tug for LeBron emotionally to go back and retire in Cleveland. But I'm with you. I think Rob Pelinka is looking at this.
Tom,
this.
For LeBron, it would be year 23 back home. It is poetic.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. You've already written the marketing for Nike and in LeBron's camp. You've already done it. Year 23. I think LeBron, it's not going to be this offseason. I think he's laying down the tracks of, in the next couple years, in his final season, his farewell tour, that he does it in Cleveland. I don't think it's going to be with the Lakers. I think that LeBron is close to 0% of retiring. Look, I had that column, little behind the scenes. We had that column ready for that as soon as the buzzer hit, the five trade options for the Lakers. And I had written it during the game, before the game, to try to figure out, like, if they lose in this game, like, where do they go? Where do they get their Daniel Gafford or their Derek Lively, their lob threat? And I was sitting there with our editor, Matt Wong, waiting for LeBron James to just, like, definitively say whether he was going to be back or not. And he left it up open in the air of saying, like, I'm not sure about that. I got to make some decisions on my own. But, like, this is what he does every year. Is I was like, dude, I don't think I was talking to Matt. I was like, I don't think that he's going to say declaratively one way or the other. He's going to leave this open in the air because he wants leverage. And I think the guy that they're going to try to pursue is, you know, Jared Allen to me is the Hail Mary, the guy that would fit perfectly with what they want to do. A defensive-minded big man who doesn't need the ball in his hands, who can finish at the rim, being a lob threat, really good short roll passer, someone that is super, super a star in his role, already a one-time all-star, and has a great contract going forward. And you're saying, why would the Cavaliers give that up? Well, it's because they already have Evan Mobley, a defensive player of the year. And if you're going to say that they've got to figure out a way to keep this second apron and figure out a way to manage this cap space or the cap in this new CBA, someone's got to go, like, long term. Evan Mobley's contract extension, the max level extension, is going to kick in next season, and they are going to be deep into the tax. Only two other teams are going to have a higher tax bill than the Cleveland Cavaliers at this point, Boston and Phoenix. So Cleveland, if they're going to figure out a way to move off some money on the edges, it's not going to work. They're going to have to break up that core four. If they do, maybe Darius Garland is the piece. It's too early to speculate here because the Cavs might win this title anyway. They've already done amazing things in this postseason. But I think Jared Allen would be like A1. I, as good as Jaren Jackson is, I don't think he's the perfect fit there for Los Angeles. I think a Jared Allen type, Walker Kessler, a similar profile of a lob threat who plays hard defensively, can protect the rim. That kind of guy is what I think that the Lakers need to target. And it can't be Brooke Lopez. It can't be a guy who's nearing 40 to be your starting center next season. I think he'd be more in like the kind of the Alex Len role, where it's like he's the backup to the guy going forward, to their young center going forward. I don't think it's Brooke Lopez as much as people are putting Brooke Lopez in LA because he was there before. I don't think he's the answer.
He's 37. Like, it's just, I know, he's dude. Not. It's like, yes, as the backup, that makes some sense. But I agree with you, Tom, as the starter, I don't think so for the Lakers. You know, Capella out of the free agents would be probably more likely as a good fit. But even then, he's over 30. Miles Turner, that's probably the best case scenario of the free agents for the Lakers. He's 29 years old. He can be a lob guy or a pick and pop guy, a solid rim protector as well. But ultimately, I thought your trade article made a lot of sense because the best options are the guys that you would trade for if you're the Lakers. And we'll see. Long offseason ahead. Pelinka was very open about how that's a huge priority for them. So we'll see in the coming weeks and months as the draft approaches, the offseason approaches, what the Lakers could do. But for now, Tom, this was fun. Great episode, Tom. Wow. Breaking news. Sad about Pop. But yeah, good talking with you today, Tom.
Yeah. And the two most, the two best words in the English language is game seven, baby. We got at least one here with Denver and the Clippers. Look, man, Denver, Jokic, just this offseason, this game matters a lot to what we're going to see going forward from Jokic. And I don't think he's going to come out in a loss and say any sort of like dramatic thing in the post-game press conference about his future. But I do think this is a very seismic offseason for the Denver Nuggets if they lose game seven against the Clippers. So it's
100%.
It's going to be big, big this game seven. So it's not just about the game. It's also about the offseason. So I can't wait, Kev. It's going to be a great weekend.
100%. A quick programming note. Our next episode will be Sunday night if the Rockets and Warriors goes to a game seven. We'll be recording after that. And if there is no game seven, we'll be recording Monday night after whatever game ones we get on that night. So look out for that podcast in your podcast feed overnight on Monday or Tuesday morning, whatever you get up and want to listen to that. Thank you for listening to today's show. Thanks to Tom for joining. Thanks to Father John and Missy for the music. Thanks to Mike, Emmy, and the whole team for producing it. Thanks to you for giving us a listen. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the games. Game seven!